Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In the first hour of the program this morning, we'll be talking about the ways in which the Civil War changed this country. And the focus may be a little bit different from that you might have heard in other conversations that we've had or other sorts of interviews you've heard or things that you have read. Our guest this morning is George Fletcher. He is professor of law at Columbia University School of Law. And we'll be talking about his book, Our Secret Constitution, the subtitle, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And in the book, Professor Fletcher makes the argument that the Civil War was one of the most significant events, perhaps the most significant event, in American legal history. It was fought over two different visions of the country. The one that prevailed was rather different than that of the founders that was embodied in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And he goes on to make the argument, in fact, that the amendments that were passed after Reconstruction, that is 13, 14, 15, in effect enacted a second American Constitution, one that was rather different from the first. And as the title of the book, however, suggests, it's something that often people fail to appreciate and understand. And it is one that has a great deal to do, though, with the way that we think about now issues like equal protection under the law, equality, and so forth. So as we talk about these issues this morning with Professor Fletcher, you certainly should feel free to join the conversation. Anyone's welcome to call, make comments, ask questions. All we ask those people, just try to be brief, just so we can accommodate as many different folks as possible and keep things moving along. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Fletcher, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Great.
We appreciate it. As I look at some of the things that you've written about previously, and it seems to me that perhaps this the subject of this book is a little bit of a departure from what you have done before. Now, perhaps it's not, because certainly there's a connection between criminal law and procedure and the kinds of things that we're talking about here in this book. But what was it that got you thinking about this and led you to write the book?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, actually, there is a deep connection between this book and a book that I wrote in 1993 called Loyalty, an essay on the morality of relationships, because loyalty is a moral virtue that is generally disregarded in our society. It's undervalued and in a market economy where we're. And the argument of our secret constitution is an extension in many respects of the argument about loyalty. I make the claim that nationhood became important after the Civil War in a way that it was not before the war. The major argument that Lincoln and the Republicans had, the Union Republicans had, for preventing the South from leaving the Union was that we were one nation, indivisible. They were not allowed to leave. There was nothing in the Constitution that prohibited them from leaving. And indeed, the Declaration of Independence, in a paradoxical way, supported their right to choose. But the idea of the organic nation, the nation to which we had to be loyal, prohibited them from leaving. So in the heat of Civil War, we formulated a new conception of who we were as Americans. We were no longer a voluntary association based upon we the people. We were now an organic, inseparable nation.
And this new way of thinking about America and this, we put it in quotes, this new constitution that follows, this was, you write, a deliberate construction of Abraham Lincoln, who, among other things, felt that this was necessary for the country to recover from the war and to continue as a country.
I think that Lincoln felt it more passionately than many of his contemporaries, but he couldn't have done this alone. There was a general mood in the country that we had matured over time and that we were no longer simply a voluntary choice in history, wanting to go our own way and separating from the English. We were now a nation that was destined to play a certain role in history. It is interesting and significant that the Civil War occurs in the same, basically in the same decade as two other major wars of national unification. The Italian War for National Unification and the German War occur in the same time. So that Lincoln appears historically to be a figure like Garibaldi in Italy or like Bismarck in Germany. These are great leaders who unified the diverse states that made up their nation. And if you look at the Civil War as a war of unification rather than as a civil war, then it makes more sense to me. It makes more sense because we've now established a country that has a different foundation from the original Association of Independent Colonies.
And you would go on and say that perhaps one of the best, most concise, most elegant sorts of statements about what this is all about is the Gettysburg Address.
Oh, absolutely. The Gettysburg Address, and I'm just thinking about the Gettysburg Address these days myself because of the way it resonates with the Declaration of Independence. You see, when Lincoln says 47 years ago, he's not referring to the Constitution. If you do the arithmetic, you'll realize you subtract 87 from 1863, and what do you get? You don't get 1787 or 1789, the dates of the Constitution. You get 1776. What Lincoln was thinking about in Gettysburg was the Declaration of Independence, not about the Constitution. And in fact, my view is that Lincoln had very little respect for the Constitution or for the Supreme Court. Because, in fact, you know, he had nothing but contempt for the Supreme Court acting under the Constitution of slavery. So that for him, the great inspiration for America was the Declaration of Independence.
At one point in the book, I think you, in a form of a table, you lay out the differences between the Revolutionary Constitution and the Civil War Constitution. To me, that's very useful to also illustrate the differences in these two competing visions of America. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we might talk a little bit about about that, and that it really breaks down to four sorts of areas.
Yes.
Where does authority come from? What's your primary value? What's your mode of government? What is the highest power? And definite contrast between between the Revolutionary Constitution and Civil War Constitution.
Indeed. So the first dimension is the one we just talked about. It's we the people as a voluntary association. That's the idea behind the Constitution. The idea behind the new Constitution that comes out of the Civil War is that we are an organic nation. We are a nation indivisible. And as Lincoln put it at Gettysburg, a nation under God. But I'll come back to that in a second. Now, the second major difference is that the Bill of Rights of 1791 is based upon the glorification of freedom. The word equality does not appear in the Bill of Rights. It does not appear in the Constitution. So we emphasize freedom at the expense of equality. In the new Constitution, which takes its legal form in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, in the new Constitution, we emphasize equality, or freedom tempered by equality. Freedom modified by equality. So from now on, equality becomes a central value. As Lincoln said, we are a country dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That was said at the time in 1776, but Lincoln made that idea come alive in Gettysburg. And then the third major difference is one that would surprise many people, but the original Constitution was not committed to democracy. It was committed to a rule by a certain elite, the elite of white property landowners. And the idea that there would be popular democracy in which everybody participated and everyone voted, that was a new idea that came out of the Civil War. And you can see how the war would generate that idea. Here you had mass participation in the war by virtually everyone, men and women, actually. And coming out of the war then was this idea that everyone had to participate in the new democracy. Now, it took time, but the beginning was granting former slaves the right to vote, and eventually the franchise spread to women, to people under the age of 21 but above 18, residents of the District of Columbia. We changed the way we elected our senators. We evolved toward the popular democracy that we have today.
Perhaps at this point I should quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who's just tuned in. We're speaking with George Fletcher. He's the Cardozo Professor of Jurisprudence at Columbia University Law School. His books include A Crime of Self-Defense, Bernard Goetz and the Law on Trial, and With Justice for Some, Victims' Rights in Criminal Trials, and the book that we're talking about here this morning, which is titled Our Secret Constitution, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy. It's published by the Oxford University Press and is in bookstores if you'd like to look at it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure that probably most people have maybe a vague, if that, idea of the Bill of Rights and what it's all about, and little or no idea of the other amendments. And I would have to include myself to, you know, if you ask me what was the 13th Amendment, I would have to get out my copy of the Constitution and look it up. So
let's go over that.
Let's go over, yeah, 13, 14, 15. What are they about?
The 13th Amendment was adopted in 1865, and that basically prohibits slavery and involuntary servitude in the United States. It's very important for reasons beyond that, but basically the idea is that it prohibited slavery. So that was the first concrete gain achieved by the Civil War. Now, the 14th Amendment is more critical because the 14th Amendment has many clauses in it that redefined the United States. Number one, and it's the 14th Amendment that converted us from the United States are to the United States is, from plural to singular. So the first thing is that everyone born on the soil of the United States is now an American. That's something totally new. Secondly, we recognize that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's also new, that the states cannot deprive people of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That becomes the foundation of all modern jurisprudence. And then the critical step forward is the recognition of equal protection of the laws. No state shall deprive any individual of the equal protection of the laws. So now we get the recognition of equality. And the 15th Amendment prohibits discrimination and the right to vote with regard to race or previous condition of servitude. So it's in effect saying black men, it's interesting, only black men therefore get the right to vote. Women didn't get the right to vote until 1920, as we know.
You, at one point in the book, are critical of those people who will argue that they can tell you what the framers had in mind when they drafted the 1789 Constitution. And when it comes to interpreting the Constitution, what we should do is read it the way they had in mind reading it.
Yes.
And which gets into a great deal of difficulty because, well, one can't be exactly sure, and it is, after all, a rather different world, and other people will make the argument that they didn't intend it to be cast in stone. They intended it to be a flexible kind of document that was capable of changing. Now, having said all that, some people might say, well, you're also doing something the same thing with respect to the Reconstruction Amendments. That is, aren't you doing a little exercise in original intent yourself, or is it that clear really what the intent of Lincoln and the others really was?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think what's significant about Lincoln is not so much what he intended, but how his Gettysburg Address was received and read at the time. I do think that Lincoln had in mind the idea of establishing a new legal order after the Civil War, but he didn't think that his speech would be long remembered, as he said. And what is surprising and significant is that this two-minute speech then became accepted in the United States as the foundation of our post-bellum legal order. It became the idea that motivated a large segment of American politics. The only problem is the courts themselves then rejected it and returned to the original Constitution. So the Lincoln's vision of a new order based upon the nation, based upon equality and based upon democracy, those ideas went underground, but they became our secret Constitution. And my argument is that they remained in force, but as an underground Constitution that has slowly been emerging and influencing our political development.
Hmm. It still seems, though, to some extent, there are people in this country that are arguing about this yet, and that would continue to say they want to continue to hold on to the Revolutionary Constitution,
yes,
the idea that the source of authority is the people, the primary value is freedom, and that this motivates acts like, well, and I know you've written about this, this motivates acts like that committed by Timothy McVeigh.
That's right.
Those people who are still, they're saying, no, this is the original Constitution, this is the idea, this is what America is all about. So
right.
I'm still struggling over it.
Right. The McVeigh case motivated me in part to write the book because I realized that there was something screwy, something wrong with the way he understood the Constitution. I knew there had to be a different story, but the other story had never been completely articulated. Because, I mean, McVeigh's crime resonated in the revolution and revolutionary patriotism, that if you think the government is the is a tyrant, if you think the government is the usurper, then you have a duty to take up arms and resist the government. Now, the idea of the government that emerges in the Civil War and after the Civil War is a different conception of government. It's the government as partner. It's the government as necessary participant in bringing about equality among citizens and bringing about democracy in the country, so that the whole conception of government changes, and we get the idea that the government has a responsibility to care for the weak, to take care of the victims of crime, to take care of people who cannot defend themselves. These are all new ideas that did not exist at the time of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights focuses exclusively on people who act, people who exercise their freedom. Whereas the new Constitution that comes out of the Civil War recognizes that people who are weak and defenseless, who are unequal or treated unequally, who are victims, they also have rights.
Why is it that this view that was articulated by Lincoln and was embodied in these amendments, 13, 14, 15, why is it that for such a long period of time after that, the courts in the United States didn't acknowledge this?
That's a very good question, but I think that the legal profession is inherently conservative. And one of the myths that drives the legal profession is that we have one continuous line of development from the original Constitution. So that the courts in the 1870s and the 1880s interpreted the new amendments as narrowly as possible in order to prevent a serious reconstruction of the country. So they, in fact, what they did was nullify the amendments, which then led to the long period of segregation and periods of systematic discrimination, which really did not end until the 1960s.
Well, I'm sure that there would be some people prepared to argue that what this was, in point of fact, was just plain and simple, it was racism, and that there was not enough support for the idea of equality for black Americans to have this vision carried through.
Right. I think this is true. And one of the things I point out in the afterword, I have an afterword in the book about election 2000, and actually, the politics of the election of 1876 were very, very important. This was the last time, 1876 was the last time that there was the kind of conflict we had in Bush versus Gore, namely where one side received a vast majority in the popular vote, but there was a conflict in the Electoral College. Now, up till 1876, the Union had maintained troops in the South, and the strong federal government insisted upon reconstruction of the South in line with Lincoln's principles. In the debate about the election of 1876, the Republicans who were then in charge, the Union Army, agreed to withdraw troops from the South in order to get Hayes elected. It was Hayes versus Tilden. But in order to get Hayes elected, they made a backroom deal, namely that they would take their troops out of the South and Hayes would become president for one term. And that, in effect, spelled the end to Reconstruction. And at the same time, the Supreme Court made these very narrow decisions that basically supported the new federal policy, like, okay, we fought the Civil War, but, you know, as one person said, the Confederacy began when Lee handed Grant his sword at Appomattox. And so what we have, in effect, is the South winning the peace, even though it lost the war.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, and others are certainly welcome to do that as well. We'll start here with a caller in Southern Illinois, and this is on our toll-free line, line number 4.
How you doing?
Yes.
It's a very interesting situation here. You know, I was just watching a thing on television about Lincoln, and it seemed to me that the whole the whole reason why they killed him was because he was pushing to give the blacks a vote. And I guess that was it. And you said two other things that really spawned something in me. It probably doesn't really deal with exactly what you're talking about, but and being educated with these declarations and things like that, you know, it's really important that I believe that we do educate ourselves on that, because our educational system doesn't seem to provide that education for us. We have to seek it to acknowledge it. But what caught me was when you said, when you reflect, and I realize it, you reflect back to the original Constitution, the original this, the original that. And the scary thing is that these people that we have now, that some are obviously wicked, you know, and others, you know, they get in there for the good, you know, but easily corrupted because of the junk that we see.
Right.
And the scary.
Well, those are interesting, interesting views. I mean, there's no doubt that we have to change the way we educate our kids about many different aspects of the Constitution. And I must say, in my own education about this, one of the things I learned in writing the book is that I, in fact, became much more sympathetic to the South's point of view in the Civil War. The general educational system emphasizes, particularly, I mean, obviously the system in the North, where I went to school in California, I was considered part of the North, that we emphasize exclusively the virtue of the Union and the great crimes of the Confederacy. In fact, there's another way of looking at it. And my own view is that slavery would eventually have been phased out anyway, and that basically what the South was fighting for was not slavery, even though there were many racists and there were many people who wanted to maintain slavery, but they were basically fighting for the option to decide when and how they would get rid of their, quote, peculiar institution. And there were arguments on their side. I mean, it's something that we have to teach as part of our national culture and national history. We can't simply disregard a major point of view that existed in a large segment of the country in the middle of the 19th century.
Well, the two things, I don't want to lose them because I did want to bring them out, but I don't want to waste a lot of your time. What you said there, man, it's pretty heavy. But anyhow, what I was wanting to get at is, you know, in the larger view, we look at that, maybe you could think about this writing a book on it or something, but in the larger view, when you look at that Civil War, we were fighting to free people from a suppressed location, a suppressed environment, slavery, of course, you know. But now I look at it in this one-world system that we're doing and trying to add amendments to this to correct that and correct that. In a sense, we are trying, again, to free a society from a suppression. But what I think what we're trying to do is put it back under suppression, because they just want to, you know, what keeps us as a nation is we are a contained thing, you know, and away from this one-world system. But when we come into that, then we come into a whole. And I was wanting to make one more comment.
Thank you very much for that thought. I appreciate it.
When you talked about Timothy McVeigh, one thing that really concerns me, though, is, you know, back when those things were written for the citizens to bear arms, it seems to me that back then people weren't hunters with guns. They were called trappers.
Right. Good point.
You know, and they were trappers for that's how they got their meal. I mean, a bullet was probably precious back then, hard to come by, you know. But now we're just considered hunters because we use guns. But back then when that was written, I look at it as they were trappers. They weren't gun hunters.
Right.
The guns were for civil defense and any defense whatsoever. I look at the system as wicked and evil anyway, and I kind of rejoice at the things that are happening, but it fears me from myself and my children.
Okay.
I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks a lot.
All right. You don't want to make any further comment on...
Well, I think those are interesting comments. I think they should stand as they are.
All right. We are about midway through this part of Focus 580. Our guest is George Fletcher. He is Cardozo Professor of Jurisprudence at Columbia University School of Law. And we're talking about some of what you will find in his book, Our Secret Constitution, the subtitle, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy, published by the Oxford University Press. And others are welcome to call 333-WILL or 9455. Same either way, that's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-WILL. Here's someone locally in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Thank
yes.
you. Now, I've missed bits, so you may have touched on this, but... And perhaps you would view this as a usurpation by the Supreme Court rather than anything intended by the Congress and the various states. But as I view it, the 14th Amendment has been used as the way of giving citizenship to corporations and has thus afforded them a humongous amount of power and allowed them to, in a lot of ways, influence democracy, or, you know, we call democracy in ways that are not very democratic.
That's an interesting point, actually. I've never researched that, but I think that resonates with another aspect of the problem, the use of the clause, all men are created equal, which appears in the Declaration of Independence. You're right. At a certain point, and I have to check the date on this, the Supreme Court recognized that corporations were persons under the Equal Protection Clause, which meant that the states could not discriminate against business corporations. And the early uses of the Equal Protection Clause in the 19th century, this I do document in my book, were about largely about corporations, largely about business enterprises. You know, in the late 19th century, the business of America was business. What we were primarily concerned about was industrial expansion. We were not concerned about civil liberties. We were not concerned about civil rights. We were concerned about promoting business. And that idea did, and it's interesting that the 14th Amendment and the emphasis on protecting persons did support that idea, that principle of industrial expansion in the 19th century. It guaranteed corporations freedom of action and protection against taxation. Discriminatory taxation, what they argued was discriminatory taxation in the state. So I appreciate your calling that to my attention. It's a good point.
Well, it seems like it could be the subject of a whole other book.
I think you're right.
And
I think it's interesting.
When you look
the way in which the notion of equality got misinterpreted to apply to corporations, very interesting.
Well, and when you look at GATT and NAFTA, I would say maybe the business of America is still business.
Well, there are many people who feel that way, but of course, you know, since the 1920s, we have had a tremendous emphasis on the protection of civil liberties and civil rights.
Well, that's
and
very
that
true, but
everything.
You know, I also think that since that time, especially, you know, from the 1970s on and certainly during the 80s and to the present, you know, we pretty much made the antitrust laws useless, or at least they don't mean anything anymore. And you look at what's happening with the FCC and the consolidation of media, you know, it's as if, you know, all those things were won so, you know, with so much effort just have been pushed aside. And you know, the individual doesn't really have much anymore compared to the kind of power that's being turned over to, you know, the people with the money.
Well, you know, this is a far-ranging conversation and raises large questions. I do agree with you on the central point that there was a critical turn in applying the Equal Protection Clause to corporations. And as I say, in the late 19th century, we were concerned primarily about equality for businesses and not equality for people. Later, we became much more concerned about equality for people. But, you know, we should realize that the enormous explosion of interest in equality really began in the 1970s. That's when we first find the Supreme Court talking about the equality of women. That's when we first find the court talking about the equality of children born out of wedlock, the equality of foreigners or aliens in the states. These are new ideas that really were not treated prior to the 1970s. So we're living in a period in which the secret constitution is in fact coming alive. It's coming out from the recesses where it's been hiding basically since the Civil War. We're finally beginning to recognize the importance of equality for human beings.
We have less than 20 minutes and a number of other callers. I hope the last caller will forgive me for wanting to go on. And actually, we have somebody on a car phone, so I want to get right to them on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I find this fascinating. And one of the remarkable things is that there's a bit of a dichotomy here. In that in current times, when a bill is written, when a law is written, my understanding is that there's a preamble to it where the legislators put down their intent. This is what we want to achieve with the law. And then they put the language of the law down. And when the courts interpret the law, they usually pay no attention to the intent, and they only go to the letter of the law. And hence, we have all these examples of, you know, unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so they interpret by the letter of the law, and they turn the intent on its head. So that's the spirit of the law versus the letter of the law. And I find it fascinating that although it has taken 100 years, a document like the Declaration of Independence, which is clearly spirit, it has no legislative authority, it just tells about the thoughts.
Good point.
Was able to turn the direction of the Constitution, which is a document of laws that has authority, was able to turn that 90 degrees.
Yes, I think it is a fascinating development, and I think that we have to be very grateful for the fact that we had this contradiction in the founding.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in fact, that would make the title for another book, The Contradiction in the Founding, because on the one hand you have the Declaration of Independence, and on the other hand you have the Constitution.
Right.
And they are really opposed philosophies. And you see that most clearly with regard to the commitment of all men are created equal. So Lincoln once said that he never had a political thought that did not come from the Declaration of Independence.
I read that.
He had no respect for the Constitution, and particularly for the Constitution as it was interpreted by the Supreme Court under Chief Justice Taney and the Dred Scott decision and all of these horrible things that led to the Civil War. So for Lincoln, the really beautiful, pristine document was the Declaration of Independence. It was the source of his religious commitment and his religious faith in the United States. For one thing, the Declaration of Independence is a religious document. We talk about God, nature's God, about providence, about our sacred honor. Even the phrase, all men are created equal, is a religious statement, because what does it mean they're created equal? By whom created equal, right?
Right.
We don't say all men are born equal. We say they are created equal, and that is very significant.
Very true. Well, I enjoy this, and I'm looking forward to
it. Yeah, well, you'll find it all in our secret constitution, if I can put in a plug.
All right. Thank you for the call. We'll continue. The next person in line in Farmer City, line two. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Wanted to address the situation of the Civil War starting before, you know, the actual outbreak in Fort Sumter. The struggles, like with John Brown,
right. The
slavery and abolitionist movement in the territories. Because the South was adamant about expanding slavery into the expanding nation, and I believe the war for independence of Texas from Mexico was fought over mainly over the principle of being having the freedom to own slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say that, I'm just curious about, you said that the South was wanting to be able to establish when it felt it was time to end slavery, but it looked like the South was intent on expanding slavery to all the new territories. So,
well, this is a debatable issue. I mean, the basic question is, what did the South have to fear from Abraham Lincoln? I mean, see, Lincoln promised and even said in Congress that they would not abolish slavery. When he was elected, the strong commitment was they would not abolish slavery. But the South had reason to fear that with more and more states being added to the Union, there were some 32 or 33 at the time, there eventually would be the 3/4 majority necessary to pass a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery. And that would have been possible if a sufficient number of free states joined the Union. That's why the big issue behind the Dred Scott fight was the Missouri Compromise, right? And whether this kind of division between free states and slave states would be recognized, and the Supreme Court held in Dred Scott that this was a violation of the Constitution because there was a basic principle of freedom written into the Bill of Rights that you have the right to own other people, that slavery was a constitutionally protected right. That's the enormous outrage that decision represents and that turned Lincoln against the Supreme Court and indeed against the Constitution. So the basic question from the South's point of view was the North bent on and having a sufficient number of free states so that they would eventually pass a constitutional amendment? Or could they trust the Union that the union would never try to, or that the union would not interfere with their own control over their own institutions. That was really what the fight was about. And I don't think it's that much different from the arguments today about states' rights. I mean, again, I think there's a lot of truth to the idea that the Confederacy began at Appomattox, that we are still debating these fundamental problems about the extent to which the states have control over their own futures.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for
your question. Thank you for the call. And then now next we'll go to line number 3 back here in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I guess I only want to know if when you said that McVeigh was hearkening back to a kind of an obsolete way of looking at his relationship to the federal government, you know, and then you say on the other hand that Lincoln thought that the Declaration of Independence was the most pristine, you know, document in our legacy. It seems kind of a muddled idea there, because you're saying that now.
Well, McVeigh's commitment was to the Constitution, not to the Declaration
right.
of Independence, right?
Right, but you're saying that his saying that he had a right to stand in judgment of the government.
Right.
And to rebel against it
right.
is a false notion. I mean, I think that
I see what you're saying. He doesn't get that from. That's a very interesting point, actually, the way you put it. You don't get an individual right to rise up in rebellion from the Declaration of Independence. The way you get that is that's a communal right. That is what the Declaration of Independence is about. It's 13 colonies signing a universal declaration that they, as a collection of communities, no longer give their consent to George III, so that it's a communal statement. It's not an individual statement. Now, what McVeigh believed was that individuals had the right to fight for freedom against tyranny. That he gets from quotations by particular founders like Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, who actually did write in the Federalist Papers that if the government became a usurper, then all men who believed in freedom should take up arms. And Jefferson, you know, when McVeigh was arrested, he was wearing a T-shirt quoting Thomas Jefferson, that the tree of liberty must be fed by the blood of patriots. So that he got this idea from some notion of the spontaneous defense by individuals of freedoms recognized in the Bill of Rights. But I appreciate your pointing out that issue. It's a very good one.
Well, what I'm thinking of is there are no collective or group efforts without leadership in the beginning. And by what you just said, the South had just as much, you're practically condoning what the South wanted to do in the first place, which was to secede from the Union. You know, they were a collection.
Absolutely right. You know, the problem is, and this is one of the contradictions in the Civil War, the South actually had a strong case based upon the Declaration of Independence. Because the Declaration of Independence says that when the consent of the governed, legitimacy comes from the consent of the governed as a group. And if the governed, the people who are being governed, withdraw their consent, then the government no longer has legitimacy. So they did indeed have a basis to secede. Now, that's why I argue so strongly in my book that the foundation of the United States can no longer be thought of as a voluntary union of states. It has to be thought of as an organic nation. And the fundamental idea that Lincoln stresses in the Gettysburg Address, and here he does differ. Well, I don't know whether he differs from the Declaration of Independence or not, but the idea that he stresses is that we are a nation. We are a nation. He doesn't use the phrase "we the people" in the Gettysburg Address. He refers constantly to the nation about five times. In the course of 268 words, he uses the word nation. So that it's critical that what we are is something, an extension of an organic group. And when you are members of an organic group, you cannot leave. You just can't do it.
Well, it sounds like semantics to me, but at any
point. Oh, it is, but it's the kind of semantic point that changes history.
Well, yeah.
Indeed, the difference between speaking about we the people and speaking about the nation was the absolute turning point.
Well, let me just ask you this, and then I'll hang up.
Sure.
I'm just curious that if, in fact, if what you say is true, and I'm sure it is to a large degree, that you know, we are to conceive of ourselves as organic. Where would you say we came upon the? Where did we get this rather corrosive foreign policy that we've got now, where a lot of the people, the majority of the people, are unaware of what we do overseas, or and you know what we, how we extend our power rather arbitrarily and often very poorly overseas.
Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting. And when it comes to foreign policy, see, the American people are extraordinarily nationalistic, and we have an enormous faith in the government when it acts overseas. And I think this is, you know, you saw this very clearly in the Gulf War. Which was a strong reaction to the skepticism that prevailed during Vietnam. But in the Gulf War, with the yellow ribbons on display every place, the country showed that it was a nation behind its military forces. Very clearly. And I think that this kind of loyalty to the American military enterprise is a long-established tradition. And in fact, one of the critical steps leading to this sense of nationhood in America was the doctrine of manifest destiny, which prevailed in the 1830s, 1840s, and led to the expansion to the West, that we had some kind of destiny as a nation, right? And this justified are seizing the entire continent. This was an enormously imperialistic effort on our part, but we felt that it was imperative in the American vision to extend ourselves from coast to coast. Now, that is the nation at work. We cannot deny it.
We have just about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is George Fletcher. He teaches law at Columbia University Law School. His book, if you'd like to read it, Our Secret Constitution, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy, published by the Oxford University Press. We have a caller standing by. We might squeeze in one more, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Caller next up is Bloomington, Indiana, line number one. Hello?
Hi. May I challenge your idea that the Declaration of Independence contradicts the Constitution.
Sure, challenge me.
You know, some of the same men who are our founding fathers, the same men who signed the Declaration of Independence, also wrote and signed and administered our Constitution. And these founding fathers were not only competent men; they were competent enough to be intellectually consistent. And after they wrote the Declaration of Independence, which, by the way, was a declaration of treason, they risked their necks rebelling against England.
Absolutely.
And some of them paid huge personal prices to defend the principles of the Declaration of Independence. Now, would these competent, honorable men, after making these kinds of sacrifices, then go write a constitution that contradicted their Declaration of Independence? I say no, they would not. And the way to look at the relationship between the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence is that the Declaration of Independence is a statement of principles, and the Constitution it's like somebody saying, I want a building, I want you to construct a building, and that building should function in such and such a way, and then the engineer, the architect, comes and he draws the blueprint,
right,
to make a building that will function according, right, to the principles. In other words, the founding fathers said, look, the Declaration of Independence.
That's a good, no, I hear you. I think it's a good analogy, actually.
Yeah.
The Declaration is the blueprint.
Hello? Good grief.
Hello. The Declaration is the blueprint, and then the building is actually built. The problem with the building is that it had a foundation necessitated by slavery that led the building to collapse. It could not survive. And at the time of the Declaration of Independence, there was an enormous fight about what the position about slavery would be, but there was a primary enemy that enabled the colonies to unite and to suppress their differences about slavery. In the time of the Constitution, right, this was no longer possible. And the entrenchment of slavery and the rejection of the principle of equality is what led to the collapse of the building.
Well, it is true that the drafters of the Constitution faced a huge dilemma. Most of them wanted to get rid of slavery.
Sure.
But they understood that if they did that, they were going to sacrifice their entire Constitution. So in order to get a Constitution, they had to sacrifice that principle.
Right, but they also had to introduce things that were rather difficult to bear in hindsight. They also introduced the Fugitive Slave Law, which said that that slaves that escaped from this Confederacy to the North would have to be returned. So it's not only that they recognized and tolerated slavery, but they build it into the very fabric of federalism.
Yeah, but
the difference between the Declaration and the Constitution, and I appreciate your challenging me on this, the Declaration is an act of unity. It took all 13 states to rebel against the Crown, whereas the underlying principle of the Constitution is federalism and a certain tolerance for differences among the states. That's why I say that in the course of writing this book, Our Secret Constitution, I developed a much greater appreciation for the position of the South. And that appreciation has to be based upon the principle of federalism and tolerance and the recognition that even though you strongly disagree with other people, you've got to figure out a way to live with them. The trouble is, it didn't work, right? We tried it, and it didn't work because the contradiction was too deep. There were too many termites in the foundation.
We're at the point, I'm sorry to say, we're going to have to stop. Maybe just about a minute, real quickly. Why is it that you think that we, as Americans, aren't more aware of the secret constitution, more aware of how it is that the war changed the way we think about what this country is supposed to be about?
I think there are basically two reasons. One is I think that we excessively glorify the Revolutionary period, and we don't pay enough attention to the Civil War and its consequences. But secondly, I think that we and all lawyers and all legal cultures prefer to cultivate the myth of continuity, and it's one of the things that supposedly makes us different from the Europeans. The Europeans are willing to recognize that they have many republics, many regimes, many different legal orders, and that changes from time to time. We think that we're different and that we have one constitution that starts in 1787 and runs to the present. My purpose is to argue that, in fact, we're much more like the Europeans, that we've had two republics, two constitutions, and that these are in fundamental conflict with each other.
Well, there we must leave it. We want to say, Professor Fletcher, thanks very much for talking.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed the questions and the discussion.
Our guest, George Fletcher, he's professor of law at Columbia University, and the book, if you would like to read it, is titled Our Secret Constitution, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy, and it's published by the Oxford University Press.